Hello and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Sarah Dykstra. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear from Annie Ropeek as she talks about President Trump's tax reform speech. John Kane, host of Eye in the Arts, talks with Greg Hertzlieb, director of the Brower Museum of Art at Valparaiso University, about the Frank Dudley display. Also, Nick Jansen talks of a lawsuit in process about ownership of beach property on Lake Michigan. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Ownership of beach property on Lake Michigan is in the balance in a lawsuit heard before the Indiana Supreme Court Thursday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports the question centers on state versus private property and could have far-reaching consequences.
Don and Bobby Gunderson owned a property in Long Beach, Indiana, on the Lake Michigan shore. Their attorney, Peter Rusthoven, argues the Gundersons' property includes any part of the beach not covered by water.
You're under the water's edge. Water comes up, there's your boundary line. Water goes down, there's your boundary line.
But the state of Indiana and three other groups disagree. Attorney Jeff Hyman represents Alliance for the Great Lakes. He says water can cover the beach permanently or temporarily, but the beach is still part of Lake Michigan.
Lake Michigan is a highly variable and dynamic system, and water levels are rising and falling. That land on the shore is part of the bed of Lake Michigan.
This case matters because if the state owns the beach up to what's called the ordinary high water mark, whether it's covered by water or not, then the beach is public property and anyone can use it. The court did not issue a timetable for its ruling. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. One of the requirements for federal funding for the double tracking of the South Shore line is now complete. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson has more.
Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District spokesperson John Parson says the environmental assessment for the double track project between Michigan City and Gary is done and is now available for public comment. Parson says the EA can be assessed online through the Double Track website.
They can provide written comments or they can attend public hearings to be held in Michigan City and the Miller Beach area of Gary to provide oral comments as part of the process.
Parson says comments will be accepted on the environmental assessment through October 23rd.
In the process of satisfying the National Environmental Policy Act, so the project will achieve satisfy one of the major requirements for federal funding, which is to complete the environmental assessment and the NEPA work.
Various alternatives had to be looked at to achieve the double track project, according to Parsons. Planners had to look at the impact the project could have on the natural environment and human environment, as well as the impact it could have on the Miller section of Gary and Michigan City.
And the fact that we go through some pretty sensitive areas in northwest Indiana, as we all know, both the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore and the Indiana Dunes State Park.
Parsons says the EA also looked at all aspects of historic preservation and the impact on the environmental justice communities. He says anyone interested can attend public hearings to be held in the Miller section of Gary and in Michigan City. And there is a hearing scheduled in the Marshall J. Gardner Center for the Arts at the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District on Wednesday, October 11th from 6 to 8 p.m. There will be another meeting from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, October 12th at the Stardust Event Center in Michigan City. Parson says the completion of the EA and the public comments are a key milestone in satisfying the National Environmental Policy Act. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. President Donald Trump called the GOP's tax reform plan a middle-class miracle as he rolled out details in a speech in Indianapolis Wednesday, September 27th. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports Trump says Indiana tax reforms should be a model for national change.
Vice President Mike Pence wasn't at the speech, but President Trump mentioned him often, touting tax reforms from during and before Pence's time as Indiana's governor.
It's time for Washington to learn from the wisdom of Indiana. We need Washington to promote American jobs instead of obstructing them.
Trump laid out reforms that would lower the corporate tax rate to 20% or less, set up 3 income tax brackets, and create bigger breaks for earning income and having kids. Trump pointed to Hoosiers he says will benefit, and he asked the crowd to tell Congress to support the plan. He singled out Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly, a Democrat who's up for re-election next year.
If Senator Donnelly doesn't approve it, because, you know, he's on the other side, we will come here, we will campaign against him like you wouldn't believe.
In a statement, Donnelly says he works for Hoosiers, not Trump or any party, and that he's waiting for more details. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek at the Indiana State Fairgrounds.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. More than 100 protesters gathered outside the Indiana State Fairgrounds Wednesday, September 27th, to give President Trump an unwelcome greeting to the Hoosier State. Not allowed inside the fairground gates, the ralliers stood along the street outside, holding signs that featured messages protesting anything from health care to tax cuts for the wealthy. You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. John Kane, host of Eye in the Arts, talks with Greg Hertzlieb, director of the Brower Museum of Art at Valparaiso University, about the Frank Dudley display. Here's that conversation.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Greg Hertzlieb, the director of the Brower Museum of Art at Valparaiso University. And welcome, Greg.
Thank you so much, John.
So you have all of those magnificent holdings at the Brower Museum of Art of all sorts, really. But you do have a really amazing selection of Frank Dudley paintings.
That's right, and it just grows all the time, and we're really grateful for it, and we learn more about the artist every time we see a new painting by him.
Well, we had our exhibit that we did together last year and earlier this year, last summer and earlier in 2017. Very popular exhibit.
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun to work on. Learned a ton. I think everybody did.
And several Dudleys were featured in that
exhibit. Oh, sure. Absolutely.
But this is all Dudley.
Right. Now, the interesting thing is with the South Shore show, that was a lot of our permanent collection. In this show currently, we have 52 paintings on display, but only 4 of them are from the Brower's collection. Many others from a lot of different lenders all across
really?
The U.S. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. So you you had to reach out to collectors.
Right.
And
exactly right. Now, the author of the accompanying publication, Jim Dabbert, in addition to being a Dudley scholar, is also a collector and so has quite a few historically important or biographically important, I guess I should say, paintings by Dudley that are included in the show, give an idea of his early style, his early years. And then we have other Midwest collections represented, both public and private.
Mm-hmm.
We have some local lenders, which is a treat. The Valparaiso Women's Association has theirs on display, freshly cleaned. The Porter County History Museum has theirs on display, also freshly cleaned. And the paintings look great after that conservation restoration.
Yeah.
They really come to life. They look fresh as the day they were painted.
Exactly. The old varnish is removed.
Right. Exactly right. And there's a grime that accumulates over the years that darkens a painting.
Uh-huh. Right.
A cleaning brings it back to its brightness.
Yeah. You see that sometimes when flash photography is used in photographing an old painting. I've noticed that underneath it sees through the varnish somehow.
That's really interesting.
Have you never experienced that?
Just in a book.
In a book.
You know, it just had seen, you know, kind of a reproduction.
Yeah. Sometime years ago, somebody left us at the Art Center. They left us a painting, early 20th century landscape, Brown County type landscape. And it was quite beautiful. And it had been hanging on one of the office walls for some time. And a Chicago dealer was offered to sell it for us, and he took a picture of it, and it was just magnificent, the color that you could see through.
That's really neat.
Yeah, so obviously he had it cleaned. Where did the Women's Association and where did those groups have their—
Yeah, now both of those were at Baumgartner's on Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago, and he's done a lot of Dudleys over the years, and— has a kind of a feel for him after
right.
a while.
Yeah.
How the artist painted and how he prepared his canvases, these kinds of things.
Well, you yourself have written a great deal about Dudley.
Yeah, and I credit Jim for Jim Dabbert, the fellow I mentioned before, uh-huh. for his help all along the way. He worked with the Dudley, or continues to be in contact with the Dudley family, as kind of an archivist,
mm-hmm.
and is always turning up new information. And so when he learns new facts about the artist, then passes them on to me.
And how long does the exhibit run, Greg?
Until December 10th.
Oh, good. So it's a nice long run.
Right. Plenty of time to see the show.
And tell me again, I just have forgotten what you said about how many pieces are in the show.
52 total, as well as some archival objects that expand on the history
mm-hmm.
of the pageant and Dudley's life.
And how far away did the farthest – what is the farthest distance that one of the paintings might have come from?
That would be Bay Area, California.
That's expensive shipping art from California.
It certainly is. But the paintings were worth it because when you see the paintings that were on loan from that particular collection, Dr. Dake,
mm-hmm.
They're jaw-dropping. I mean, they're historically important and just beautiful. Important visual chronicles of bathers at the dunes
mm-hmm.
and some of his more majestic, large-scale landscapes.
Mm, that sounds fantastic.
It's a real treat.
Great. Well, thanks, Greg. Thanks
well,
for
thank
putting
you.
Together the show, and I'm looking forward to seeing it myself.
Very good.
Thank you for coming, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. We had on Regionally Speaking on Tuesday, September 26th, two perspectives on the quest by Hoosier communities to seek Amazon's second world headquarters. First, from Northwest Indiana native and Indianapolis Star columnist Matthew Tooley, and then from economist Michael Hicks, the executive director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University.
Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson's offering her city as the site for Amazon's second world headquarters isn't such a crazy idea, well, at least not in the opinion of Matthew Tooley. He wrote an Indianapolis Star column about it back on September 21st. I called him up and asked him about it. Matt, tell us what got you interested in this topic to make a column out of it that runs statewide and now probably worldwide, starting out from the Indianapolis Star.
First of all, thanks for having me on. And I'm from Gary, Indiana. I lived in Gary until I was 10 years old. Went to high school in Portage. And then after college, worked at the Gary Post Tribune back in the early 90s. In a variety of positions as a reporter there. And so, you know, my family goes back generations in Gary, and I have a deep interest in the city, but also fondness for the city. And over the years, while I've been down here in Indianapolis, I've every couple of years, I've come up to Gary to kind of write about its challenges, things that are working well, things that aren't working well. And my goal always is to bring the situation of what's going on in Gary down here to central Indiana into the area where, so much of the state center of power is. And just to remind people that there, we have the city in Indiana that has huge, huge challenges and obstacles, but also, I believe, huge opportunities for both the city and the region up there, but also for the state. I also like to remind people that, you know, for a long, long, long time, people might have their image of Gary, but for a long time, Gary did way more than its fair share to pay the bills of the state of Indiana, and people shouldn't forget that. So I come up, from time to time to write about it because of my personal connection to the city, because of its importance to the state. And in this case, I was really struck. I thought Mayor Freeman Wilson just, hit it out of the ballpark with both her message to Amazon, but the way it was delivered. And most important, I'd be very surprised if Amazon took Gary, Indiana. I wish they would. If I had a magic wand, I'd say for a number of reasons that we could talk about, I think there's such great opportunity up there. I don't think it'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
But But to me, that wasn't really the important part of what she did. The important part was the message that it sent, using this issue as the hook, but the message that it sent to the state and hopefully also to the business world at large about what Gary may have to offer.
What did you see in your experiences, of course, being not only a former Gary resident, a Northwest Indiana yeah. resident, but a resident and resident print journalist, about Mayor Freeman Wilson going to the old school method of using a newspaper advertisement? Oh, who would ever do that these days? But it's, how corny it sounds, but how direct and how interesting she should use that method to get her word out to the world, pretty much.
Yeah, you know, obviously as a newspaper guy, I guess I hadn't really thought about the business side of that. That hey, you know, if it works, it could be good for my business. Mm-hmm. But I think just from a very practical standpoint, there really wasn't another way to make a splash. You know, newspapers may not have the reach that they used to have, but they still have more reach than most things. And the New York Times business section, I guarantee, is read by, well, I shouldn't guarantee it, but I assume is read by Mr. Bezos. And, mm-hmm. and it is kind of interesting that she's picked the New York Times and not the Washington Post, since he owns the Washington Post. But I thought that was probably a smart move to not pick, you know, it would have seemed a little too groveling to pick his own paper.
Well, and you know he reads the competition. So he has to read it.
Absolutely. Yeah. But just from a practical standpoint, I don't know that there's something else that she could have done that would have reached as many people as a newspaper ad. And it wasn't so much just who was going to see it in the newspaper, but it was, you know, yeah, there'd be people that would see it in the newspaper, but then most importantly, then it would be covered by, you know, not just guys like me at regional papers like mine, but the Washington Post, I saw, did a pretty big piece on the effort. And, you know, so it was a clever way, and you got to give her credit. She was the first mayor to do that, the only mayor, as far as I know, to do that. And so I don't know what Bezos is thinking, but I assume that he has now at least heard of Gary's bid, and just about every big or medium sized city in the country would love to know that he at least has heard of their bid.
We're talking with Indianapolis Star columnist Matthew Tully. He wrote a column not long ago after Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson, representing the city of Gary, decided to put an ad in the paper, in this case the New York Times business section, offering Gary, Indiana as the place that Jeff Bezos should visit for the next Amazon headquarters. Of all the cities in the U.S. and Canada who will be bidding for this opportunity to be headquarters number two for Amazon, she said, why not Gary? And let's take a look here at that ad, Matt, and tell us, breaking it down, the things that you felt that she wrote best in that ad that certainly got, I'm sure, Jeff Bezos' attention, but everybody else's attention, why Gary, Indiana shouldn't be kicked out of the running for it.
Yeah, I think, obviously, she mentioned some very basic things, you know, that you know, a city can't buy. You can't buy the proximity to Chicago. You know, you have the commuter rail line, the commercial rail line, the airport, which may not be the international airport that Amazon would need, but it at least could help somewhat. You know, the transportation grid, the location in the middle of the country. I mean, there's a lot going for it. I thought, to me, what I've always thought about Gary, and I've talked over the years to numerous candidates for governor and governors, and they all seem to have the same agreement that that if you look at Gary, I mean, and she mentioned the vast amount of vacant and abandoned homes and commercial properties, and obviously that's a deterrent for the city when it's trying to sell itself. But if you are talking about building from scratch, if you're talking about having a clean slate and somewhere to go in America that's in a heavily populated area, but offers just thousands upon thousands of acres upon which to build at key locations for transportation, you know, I just can't think of anywhere better than Gary. And you know, I thought the state for years has kind of missed this opportunity to take advantage of cheap real estate that needs to be redeveloped. Wow. That is so close to Chicago, so close to highway, so close to the lake, so close to rail. I've always thought that Gary, you know, has a huge opportunity. And my column wasn't really about, hey, Amazon needs to go to Gary. I have not studied all of the bids around the country. And from a business standpoint, I am in no way qualified to say that Amazon should go to Gary. What I wanted to get across most of all here in Indiana was that we should all be rooting for Gary's comeback. That it would be I can't think of anything that would be better for Indiana as a whole than for one of our major cities that has struggled for so long, that has so much opportunity to have a great comeback.
Now, what kind of reaction have you gotten from folks there in central Indiana since the column went out in the Indianapolis Star and online as well, too, besides the local print paper? What kind of reaction have you gotten from folks there in the Circle City and the area as well? Because they're obviously going to vie for it as much as anybody else. Mm-hmm. But they've got to have something interesting to say about Gary, Indiana, trying for it.
Yeah, and that was an interesting thing for me to write the piece. I'm here. I live and work here in central Indiana, and I love it down here. And I root for central Indiana to win, you know, 99 times out of 100. This case, you know, if I was, you know, in a position of, you know, if I was the governor, in looking at this, I'd be like, boy, Indianapolis is doing great. Had so many victories, and let's keep that going. That's great for the state. Obviously, mm-hmm. It's the economic engine for the state. But, you know, if you're looking at the state as a whole, I just kind of feel like, you know, that strengthening that Northwest Corridor, especially a city like Gary that you know, like I said, has so much potential to, you know, to have a great comeback. It just seems like it seems to me that would be best for the entire state. As far as the reaction, the main group of people I heard from, and there are so many of us down here, are people that live down here but have connections to Northwest Indiana. I mean, sometimes I feel like every third person I know down here grew up in Lake or Porter County. So I heard from those folks, and the reaction was kind of crazy to say. I think it was all positive. I can't think of one negative.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Very rare when you write a newspaper column, I have to say.
I'm sure that there's some Marion County or Hamilton or Johnson County snobs that say, "Ooh, Gary, Indiana. You know, why should they get it?" But it's not beyond the realm of possibility. You have to think about this.
No, and that was a big part of why I wrote what I wrote and why I've tried to write about Gary over the years is that there is a lot of there are a lot of stereotypes and preconceived notions and thoughts about Gary from people who haven't spent time there, that maybe, you know, have seen, you know, listen, no one's going to deny that you drive through Gary and mm-hmm. see a city that has decayed. But I kind of felt like, you know, since I have this little platform, you know, in my newspaper that I've over and have a certain history that maybe a lot of people don't have, that it's part of my job is to occasionally remind people, hey, this is an Indiana city too. These are Hoosiers too. Not only would it be great for Indiana for Gary to have a renaissance, but we owe it to our fellow, you know, Hoosiers to be rooting for their comeback.
Well, you know that there probably, besides yourself, was one other person that was very interested after seeing the column. And, of course, we used to carry his show when he had it on the radio up here, Dan Dockich. He's the only guy I know of who would ever do a radio promo talking about Coney King on Broadway in Gary. So say you stop at Coney King, get yourself a sandwich there. So
one of the first texts I got when I wrote the piece was from the governor, who liked what I had to say. So,
that's great.
You know, I think there's a lot of people that have a deep interest in what's going on up there.
Well, if you want to read this column in more detail, go on to indystar.com and in the search type in Matt Tully's name and the name of the column is "Don't Dismiss Gary, Indiana's Amazon Dreams." And Matt, thank you for being with us to talk about it.
Anytime. Thanks so much.
We're going to look into another viewpoint here concerning the plans by Amazon founder executive Jeff Bezos to set up a second world headquarters, and now the big rush for people and organizations and communities that would like to host that new headquarters. We're talking now to find out more, at least about the impact in Indiana and what we should consider here if we're really and truly sincere in wanting to be up in the running for that second world headquarters for Amazon. Talking with Michael Hicks, he is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University. Michael, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Delighted to be with you.
Got a chance to put out a column here recently. It's in Howie Politics Indiana on the subject of Amazon being interested in looking for new locations for the new home. And we know that there are a number of communities in Indiana, the city of Gary, one of them to be sure, that would like to set up this opportunity here. But there's some things that we have to really consider if we're really and truly interested in this. And you spent some time in writing about that. Tell us, if you will, what should we as Hoosiers be looking for? And as if the Amazon folks are really interested in Indiana for a place for their headquarters.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. All of us, both taxpayers and interested citizens who are considering economic development issues. You know, I think there are a couple things. The first one is it's a good opportunity to tell the Indiana story. Indiana is a lot better place to do business and to live than I think a lot of folks outside in the rest of the world understand. It's easy living here. I say I've been here 10 years, which is the longest I've lived anywhere. I've lived in 14 states and a number of countries, and this is a pretty solid place to do business, fairly decent human capital, particularly in some of the urban centers. So, you know, I take pride in Indianapolis and, you know, Gary saying, look, you know, come consider us. It's a good marketing tool. But when you start digging down into the problem, you have to really understand that we're talking about 50,000 jobs of over $100,000 each. And that's bigger than all but one city in Indiana. And so, you know, in terms of we don't have, outside of Indianapolis, we don't have 50,000 people making $100,000 anywhere other than, you know, maybe Hamilton and Marion County. So it's a huge, potentially transformative relocation event for some place somewhere in the country. And I think that lends itself to excess in terms of, you know, giving away the farm in terms of incentives and promises because, you know, that is an eye-popping, career-changing number for a politician or an economic developer. And I think that's where we have to be most worried.
Do you think that there's this concern that with such an attractive opportunity there, a lucrative opportunity, I'm sure, for some, that there might be this concern that maybe we're going to sell our souls, so to speak, to do our best to try to sell Amazon in Indiana?
Well, it's still our souls and our kids' souls and our great-grandkids' souls. Yeah. I mean, to put this in context, it compared against what I think was an abominable choice of public policy in Wisconsin with Foxconn. They're, you know, they were promising somewhere between 3,000 and maybe 10,000 more $50,000 a year jobs, and they financed it. It's depending on who you ask and how they enforce it, you know, $1 million to $1.5 million per job to get those over like 25 years. And the payback period on that investment is like 2.5 times longer than the technology has been around. So I don't think any economist believes that that's a realistic, you know, sort of investment. It's a political piece of hackery, and if you apply those figures to this Amazon deal, it'd be worth like $25 billion, which is what I think half the budget of the city of Chicago in a given year. You know, it's 25 times Indianapolis's city budget. So that's, you know, you're not going to see anything quite that big. But what I think, you know, cities are likely to do is to say, you know, we'll permanently abate property taxes, we'll, you know, build infrastructure for you, you know, roll out the red carpet for this firm. And the problem with that is that the municipality that does that is only going to benefit if the workers live there. And so I often chuckle is that, you know, if this activity were to come to Gary, which would be a great, you know, feather in the hat of a mayor who's doing great things there, you know, trying to improve the city. Where would the workers live? Are they going to live in Gary? Are they going to live in Porter County? And so that's where the benefits are. So I think just understanding from low to left official where the effects are going to be is a big challenge. And I think that's particularly acute in Indiana, where the workers are likely to disperse over a 5 or 6 county region, no matter where it locates.
Well, yeah, because it's very possible that, say, that Gary is chosen to be the site for HQ2. that you know it's not likely that, that they're going to be located in Glen Park or even in Miller, for that matter. They're liable to be living in South Lake County, as you say, in Porter County. Maybe they'll branch out even to Southwest Michigan, I suppose, because they'll feel it's not that far of a commute.
No, not at all, and that's a good thing. Don't get me wrong, that's a good thing. If they were to locate in Gary and you were to see 50,000 jobs in, you know, spread out across that area, that would be a wonderful thing. I would be very cheered about it. The problem is that the Gary would be paying all the incentives, all the property tax incentives, and all the benefit would flow to the location that the workers alight in. And so there are fundamental problems with structuring an incentive package that's going to work and also benefit that local community. That's the, I think, one of the underlying worries. And the other one is simply that, you know, Jeff Bezos strikes a hard bargain. He's a very, very successful businessman. You know, is he going to come in and promise something that doesn't really materialize? That's been almost an enduring story over the past, you know, half century. The businesses are you know, very savvy at eliciting you know, big commitments from communities and not keeping their side of the bargain. And that's not, and I don't have any evidence that he's done that in the past, but there, you know, with billions of dollars at stake and local governments having very little recourse to, you know, recoup their money, that's a very strong temptation.
And we know that there's one person in particular in the city of Gary that's still smarting from what Donald Trump said years ago about wanting to beef up Northwest Indiana and the city of Gary in particular. Chuck Hughes still smarts at the way that the city of Gary and the Chamber of Commerce in particular was treated when Donald Trump decided to do the expansion at the casino. And things didn't happen there as had been promised by many people and Mr. Trump at that time in particular. So concerned about that. Also, too, I know that there's talk about the fact that Jeff Bezos would like to look for some spot to locate the next headquarters that has a self-standing building, something that they don't have to build or nobody has to build. And that kind of narrows the field, I suppose, in the potential candidates, does it not?
Well, right, but you know, think about it. Where the only 50,000 person ready building I've ever been in is the Pentagon,
mm-hmm.
right? So you know, the World Trade Center's held a third of that capacity. So you know, I don't think realistically that's going to exist. What he probably would have to look for is a campus. You know, a campus of, you know, 1,000 acres, 1,500, 1,700 acres that already had water and sewer system available or could be readily extended to. That certainly, Northwest Indiana would be a good place for that.
Yeah.
It would have to have transportation infrastructure to allow people to move there, so something on the, you know, rail lines or, you know, interstate would have to be proximal. And then the local governments are going to have to, maybe with the help of state transportation authorities, build the on and off ramps. 50,000 people coming to and from a town and to work every day. That's like all of Muncie in one place or all of Terre Haute in one place commuting at one time. So those are fairly large. I think the real problem, though, isn't the public infrastructure. It is his concern about finding a place where he can have over a 36-month or 72-month period hire 30,000 to 50,000 men and women, or relocate some share of them. They'll relocate, obviously, some 5,000 out of those who can operate a corporate headquarters, you know, 2.0 that would be as effective as the one in Seattle. So in many ways, what they're going to be looking for today is what Seattle was 20, 25 years ago, which is a place that could attract a lot of young people, could attract a lot of professionals, could, you know, be big enough to have all the air transit and that sort of thing, but yet not so big that it would be so congested as a Los Angeles or a Metro D.C., Baltimore D.C. area or New York.
So it sounds like that we certainly should not hang our hat, so to speak, on Indiana becoming the possible site for that second headquarters for Amazon.com. But it's very possible we could get it here, but we should be probably prepared for all the pitfalls that it's going to bring, I would imagine.
Well, right, and I actually think that by going through a self-analysis of what's good and bad about our communities, how our incentives work, we could learn a lot from this. But I mean, there are really, you know, maybe three places where this could work. It could work in, obviously, in Indianapolis, which keeps coming up in the top 5 to 10 places that could this could work.
Yeah.
It might could work outside of Chicago, the Indianapolis, or the Indiana side of Chicago somewhere. It might could work outside of Louisville. And that's about the only three places that I think that have the transportation infrastructure, the airport, the interstates that would really work. I mean, so if those three places in Indiana were to sit down and say, what incentives do we have? What could we do? Do we have the people? And frankly, the Indianapolis and Chicago are, you know, going to be better on the people side of this. And then what we don't have, what's missing here is the big issue. So even if Amazon doesn't come and you don't pay all those incentives, but you have done a good job evaluating what the community has, other firms will come there. And so once somebody goes to Amazon, once that Amazon headquarters is built, that's not going to be an attractive place to build another headquarters. You don't want to be – there's no scale economies or agglomeration in those sorts of headquarters. You don't want to be competing with those jobs for workers if you're a smaller headquarters, which every headquarters in the world is smaller than Amazon. Yeah. So I think that would be part and parcel to think about. So if you are Indianapolis or the greater Chicago area and you do the things to attract this and they don't come, then you still are likely looking at a place that's going to enjoy this type of growth from other companies over the coming decades.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.com. Where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program's link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure to search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sarah Dykstra.